Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito has been making the rounds in Washington, talking with senators about whether he's inclined to overturn Roe v. Wade. But as the rest of us try to determine where Alito stands on abortion, on family structure, men's rights, and women's rights, there's one case that tells a big story. It's Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a 1991 Pennsylvania case which raised the hotly contested question of whether a woman should be required to notify her husband before she has an abortion. Appeals Court Judge Alito became a hero to the anti-abortion right when he voted in the minority to uphold the spousal notification law. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor struck down the law. It's the case that now informs a brimming debate over men's rights, abortion, patriarchy, and the future of women's rights in America. It's also the case that seems to draw a bright line between Sam Alito and Sandra Day O'Connor. This hour on Point, husbands, wives, abortion, and Sam Alito. You can join the conversation. Should a wife have the right to make the abortion decision on her own? Should a husband have the right to be informed? Are you with Alito in saying inform the man, or are you with O'Connor in saying free the woman? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Falls Church, Virginia, is David Savage. He's Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. David, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Tell us about Sam Alito's visits to the Senate. How are they going down?
Well, he's been doing the usual courtesy calls and talking about, as you said, talking about the importance of precedent. That's a way of telling some of the moderate to liberal senators that I'm not anxious to overturn Roe versus Wade. He, of course, never answers the ultimate question. The part of that dance is you talk about things. You know, they talk in code. You can say, I support a right to privacy, Senator, and I believe in precedent, but I can't really tell you what I will do when Roe versus Wade, if it comes before the court to be overturned. I can't tell you that.
We're reading that he's getting generally a kind of thumbs up from both sides on the abortion issue. Yesterday he got praise from Senator Sam Brownback, who's fiercely anti-abortion. This is the type of nominee I've been asking for, Senator Brownback said. He also got praise from Senator Joe Lieberman, who is pro-abortion. Headline said Alito signals reluctance to overturn Roe v. Wade. What's that grounded in, David?
Well, I think it does. You can't put a whole lot of stock in some of those comments because, obviously, as you said, Sam Brownback and Joe Lieberman don't agree. He's just simply saying what John Roberts and a lot of the other successful Supreme Court nominees is that I believe greatly in precedent. Roberts went through a lot of the stuff at his hearings talking about how important precedent was, but he didn't actually promise he wouldn't overturn Roe versus Wade. So I think Joe Lieberman and Susan Collins can be pleased if he says, I have a great respect for precedent. I would be very reluctant to overturn a 30-year-old precedent. But in the end, I don't think either side is going to know for sure what he's going to do when and if he gets on the Supreme Court.
David, how does this nomination look just so many days in at this point? Hearings not until after the first of the year, but we saw Harriet Meyer's meltdown pretty quickly. How does this one look? What are the issues that are shaping up as key?
I think he's in very good shape. If you're going to, if you're the opposition and you're going to defeat the president's Supreme Court nominee, particularly when, in this case, the Republicans have 55 votes, it seems to me you either have to make the case that this person is not qualified by background or temperament to be on the Supreme Court, and that's not an issue in this one. Or you have to say, this person is an extremist, an ideologue, and usually that case is made when the nominee has given speeches or made writings in the past that said really sort of radically conservative things that set people off. Robert Bork did that. Clarence Thomas did it. He wrote a lot of op-ed pieces that were very conservative. This guy is a very close-to-the-vest judge, a very cautious judge, somebody who's not written and said a lot. He's not somebody who comes across to people as an ideologue. And so I would say he's in very good shape.
Do you see the Democrats laying the groundwork for a filibuster, or are they not even trying?
Not laying the groundwork and not saying they're going to try, but always leaving it open. I mean, you never know what's going to happen in nominees. You know, so we may learn a lot of things about him that we don't know, and we may be surprised. But all the Democrats are talking, are sort of saying they're not thinking filibuster.
And is there a date certain for the beginning of Senate confirmation hearings, David?
It's January 7, I believe, the sort of the first full week that the Senate is in session in January.
And until then, lots of speculation. David Savage, thanks for catching us up on the course of that nomination.
Thank you, Tom.
David Savage is Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Falls Church, Virginia. We're talking this hour about abortion, women's rights, men's rights, and Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Cynthia Gorney. She's a professor of journalism at the University of California at Berkeley and the author of Articles of Faith, A Frontline History of the Abortion Wars. Cynthia Gorney, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
And joining us from South Bend, Indiana, is Richard Garnett. He is professor of law at the University of Notre Dame. He clerked for Chief Justice William Rehnquist, 1996 and 97. Richard Garnett, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Cynthia Gorney, we want to wade into this Planned Parenthood versus Casey case to try and make out what the real implications of it are. Everyone's trying to figure where Sam Alito stands. Some of that may be explicit in what he says and doesn't say about Roe v. Wade. Other things may be implicit in his kind of view of the world of men and women and marriage and very human relationships. Take us back to this case and what was on the line here, particularly about spousal notification. Can you lay it out for us?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that are important to bear in mind with regard to the Pennsylvania law that was at issue here. This was a big omnibus sort of catch-all abortion law that was written immediately after a previous big Supreme Court ruling, Webster, which effectively said to the states, look, we're not ready to overturn Roe v. Wade right now or think about it, but we urge you states to come back to us with laws that might give us a clearer idea of whether to consider overturning Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And Pennsylvania, which has a long, rich history of being one of the most active right-to-life states in the country, immediately set to work doing that. And the legislators there wrote a big law that addressed abortion in a number of different regulatory aspects, including an informed consent provision requiring women to be told a couple of days before the abortion what was going to happen and so on. And one part of this law was a requirement that any woman contemplating an abortion notify her husband or, and this is important for people to keep in mind when they think about it, or sign a piece of paper with no other enforcement mechanism, attesting that notifying her husband would basically not be in her best interest, that there was an element of danger or fear of bodily injury if she did so. And Judge Alito was, of course, on the appellate court, as you indicated, and he was a dissenting vote. The appellate court struck that down. Upholding,
you can ask for that spousal notification. In other words, you cannot ask
that's
for that.
Right.
They said, but,
that's
but he dissented.
That's correct. He dissented, and what Alito basically said was, the danger here would affect such a small percentage of the women that I don't think this constitutes what we're now thinking about as an undue burden. Most women tell their husbands. The number of women who think that it would really not be in their best interest to tell their husbands is such a tiny minority that, in Alito's reasoning, it doesn't make sense to strike down this whole law on their behalf.
Now,
that was his reasoning.
That was his reasoning. The case went on to the Supreme Court, and Sandra Day O'Connor, presumably whose earlier judgments he was attempting to follow, came back with what reads to me, a layman, like a pretty fierce response to that. She wrote, "The law embodies a view repugnant to our present understanding of marriage. Women do not lose their constitutionally protected liberty when they marry." That looks like a pretty hard smackdown, Cynthia Gorney.
It does. I must say that in non-legal terms, it reads to me like a woman who has been through many years of what was presumably a good marriage saying to a guy, "You don't get it here. This is my decision." And The other phrase that appears in that ruling is this troubling degree of authority over his wife. That also comes from the majority opinion there.
So here we go. The justice that he is now in line to replace pushing back very hard on Sam Alito's view. On the other hand, we see lots of public opinion polls saying, well, sure, the husband should be told. Richard Garnett, does this demonstrate a fundamentally different kind of view of the world of family relations, of women's rights between Alito and O'Connor?
Yeah, thanks. I guess I don't think that it does. And I think Professor Gorney set up the issue very fairly and well. I guess my view would be that Justice O'Connor, notwithstanding the obvious fact that she's going to be better able to speak to the concerns of women in this context than Sam Alito would be, I think it's a mistake to think that the Pennsylvania law gave husbands authority over their wives or represented an effort to take away liberty and allocate it to husbands. I mean,
you're saying Sandra Day O'Connor, Supreme Court Justice, was mistaken. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. I think Judge Alito, in his opinion, it wasn't so much that he was conflicting with Justice O'Connor.
He conflict directly? I mean, she said it embodies a viewpoint repugnant to our present understanding of marriage. That sounds like direct conflict to me.
Well, it's only conflict if Justice O'Connor had said that before Judge Alito has rendered his opinion. And the judge had some opinions to work with. Professor Gorney told you about Webster. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There were a few others. And when you read the opinion in Casey, his dissent, it's quite clear he's doing his best, as was the majority, to get a sense of what Justice O'Connor thinks an undue burden was.
But he ended up in direct conflict, didn't he, after the fact, when she came back? I mean, these have to be opposing views, don't they?
Well, they do, but let me finish this. Yes. He had to reason from opinions that Justice O'Connor had written in other contexts and mm-hmm. tried to draw analogies. Now, it turns out that he was mistaken about what Justice O'Connor was going to try to think. He's hardly the first judge to have been mistaken in trying to guess what she was going to do. Justice O'Connor, I think, misunderstood what the Pennsylvania law was doing, and that Judge Alito actually better understood the court's precedents than she did in that case.
We've got to take a short break here. It all leaves us having to judge what Judge Alito, Justice Alito, would think on his own 2 feet on the bench. Cynthia Gorney, Richard Garnett, please stand by. We're talking about abortion, women's rights, men's rights, men's rights, and Sam Alito. You can join us 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about abortion, about women's rights, men's rights, and Supreme Court nominee Sam Alito. Talking about the case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, where Alito and Sandra Day O'Connor parted ways. We've been joined by Richard Garnett, professor of law at the University of Notre Dame, and Cynthia Gorney, author of Articles of Faith, A Frontline History of the Abortion Wars. You can join us as well. What do you think? Should a wife have the right to make the abortion decision on her own? Should a husband have to be informed? Are you with Alito saying inform the dad or with O'Connor saying free the mom? And what's between the lines of this case as we look at this Supreme Court nominee? Are we talking about a return to patriarchy here, a climb down on women's rights, or just a justified assertion of men's rights? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Richard Garnett, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you there going to the break. But I really want to understand, you said he was trying to follow Sandra Day O'Connor's earlier decisions and writing on this issue, but in the end, they ended up in quite different places. Does that not speak to their sort of fundamental posture that they bring to this question, that Alito would bring to this question on the court?
Well, no, that's a fair point, and I do think that obviously we have the evidence that Justice O'Connor, in the end of the day, approached this issue differently than Judge Alito did. But I think what's important to remember when we're trying to decide whether this represents some statement of hostility to women's rights on Alito's part, that what he was trying to do was to extrapolate from Justice O'Connor's opinions what exactly she thought this undue burden standard meant. And Justice O'Connor would be the first to tell you that it's been applied inconsistently and unpredictably. And I think Justice Alito would say, and I don't think this is an unreasonable view, that of course a man has no authority over a woman's decision to have an abortion. But the question here was whether it was reasonable for Pennsylvania to think that by requiring in some very limited, frankly, circumstances notification, that the law might facilitate some good communication and perhaps some more reflective decision making on the part of both parties. Now, obviously, reasonable people can disagree about these laws, although most people seem to support him. But I don't take Judge Alito to be endorsing a strong theory of men's rights. What I take him to be doing is just saying that Pennsylvania, it was permissible for Pennsylvania to decide that this was a good idea. I don't think he was saying that it was a good idea, just that the Constitution permits Pennsylvania's legislatures to give it a try.
Of course, that's what it's all about when things come before the court, whether the judges give a green light or not. Cynthia Gorney, help us understand here the kind of what sounds like the high frontier of women's rights that Sandra Day O'Connor, in the evolution of her own thinking, was protecting. When she says that Judge Alito's this law that he supported embodies a view repugnant to our present understanding of marriage, that women do not lose their constitutionally protected liberty when they marry, what's she getting at there? What's the definition of women's rights that she's working with?
Well, Tom, there's a very important point that needs to be stressed here for your listeners. This case and ruling were somewhat unusual in that the lead opinion, the one that you're referring to, mm-hmm. was actually jointly written. The more common practice in the Supreme Court is that the majority, that one justice writes what's called the majority opinion, and the justices who agree sign on.
Right.
In this particular case, three justices, Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, and David Souter, all signed on as joint authors of that opinion.
Does that make this any less her view?
We don't know.
But her name was at the bottom of it, or the top, or both.
Yes, as were Souter's and Kennedy's. My mm-hmm. guess would be just gut. No, I mean, David Savage would be able to tell us this much more because he's much more familiar with mm-hmm. the justices themselves. My gut would be that if you're sitting in that room, you probably have the woman making the strongest argument that this is not the business of the husband. But we don't know. It's entirely possible that Anthony Kennedy or David Souter found right. this provision of the law equally offensive, and we don't know who actually wrote the words, this troubling degree of authority over his wife. It could have been an angry clerk.
Though
so it's important
level,
to bear that in mind.
That doesn't matter because decisions are written all the time by clerks or whoever. It's
right.
who signs off on it. And Sandra
exactly.
Day O'Connor's name
exactly.
is right on this.
Yeah.
So what I want to get to this point of the definition of women's rights, because I think as people look at this case, you know, many will support it. I mean, we see the opinion polls. Pew Research Center, this is just a week ago, 72%, what is it now, even higher
right.
of Americans support the husband being informed. And yet the Supreme Court has been talking about definitions of women's rights here that Sandra Day O'Connor was on to. How would you describe or define that definition? What is it that would leave, in her view, a woman free to make this decision on her own that would see her liberty as trammeled if she had to inform her husband? What's the understanding of women's rights implicit in that?
Well, for a long time, of course, this giant public conversation has turned, among many other things, on the question of whether during various points in pregnancy, and Justice O'Connor has always drawn the line at viability, fundamentally you're talking about one person or two. Is that pregnant woman one person with full decision over what happens to her body in that pregnant state,
mm-hmm.
or are you really talking about two people? And the country remains very confused and distressed about this question. And I think that question becomes far more emotional and intense when you're trying to decide whether the father, if that is two people, the father of that second person, has some kind of a say in what's going to happen.
But just to be clear on this, this decision would seem to indicate that Justice O'Connor was saying it's one person. It's
Justice
the mother.
O'Connor did seem to be saying in this case, when you come right down to it, fundamentally it's one person. And that is one of the strongest articulations. The standing joke among abortion rights lawyers about Justice O'Connor had always been, up until that case, she's never found a burden that she didn't like. And in Casey, she finally found one. She had always expressed this undue burden notion, and in the previous rulings indicated that this would not be an undue burden, that would not be an undue burden. This one was. And I must say that it is interesting to me that she drew her line not at consent. Let's remember the distinction between consent and notification.
Right.
This was a notification law.
But that means
so
even
in,
notification
right.
alone she saw right. as an undue burden.
Right. Right.
Mm. Richard Garnett, so here we look at Sam Alito now, and you're kind of downplaying the distinction here, but I'm not sure it's so small. Where do you think he comes down on whether it's one person's decision or two? And doesn't where you come down on that have an awful lot to say about how you define the parameters you draw around women's rights?
Sure, I bet it does. I guess Judge Alito, I suspect, like Justice O'Connor, would think that at some point in the pregnancy, particularly late in pregnancy, the legislature is entitled to act in ways to protect its interest in the life of an unborn fetus.
But we're really talking about not the legislature as much at the moment as the husband. Judge Alito has ruled on behalf, in the interest of authority, in many cases, we're told, across a whole spectrum of issues. Do you see a kind of deference to the father? Do you see a kind of reassertion of patriarchy in his view of the world in this case?
Yeah, Tom, I don't mean to be difficult here, but I don't see that at all. And in fact, I think a better reading of Judge Alito's opinions across a wide spectrum of issues reveals him very often defending the rights of the little guy, particularly in religious freedom cases, for instance. I don't think, and maybe we just disagree on this, I don't think that this case involves Judge Alito endorsing an idea of male authority over wives.
Embodies a view repugnant to our present understanding of marriage. Women losing their liberty. That would seem that's the Supreme Court expressing describing this as repugnant.
Yeah, that was Justice O'Connor's view, and I think she's mistaken about that.
All right. I want to get a frontline view of this ruling and how it may be seen from the trenches. Susan Hill joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. She is president of the National Women's Health Organization. It's a network of 8 freestanding abortion clinics, including the last abortion clinic in Mississippi, in Jackson. Susan Hill, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
When you look at Planned Parenthood versus Casey, this case we're talking about, you look at Senator O'Connor's ruling, Judge Alito's dissenting opinion. What do you see as the stakes here? In your understanding of how abortion actually works, why does this matter?
Well, I think I always say that on the front lines, there's never black and white. There's always gray. And the law is written, or Casey was written, and Alito, I guess, agreed with the fact that it wasn't an undue burden for a husband to be notified. Every day in our clinics and every other clinics in the country, women come in who have made their own private decision, personal decision about abortion, and also about who they tell, including their husband, or not tell him. The government certainly doesn't know a marital situation better than a husband and wife know it. I really can't believe states' rights or writers or anything believe that the state should intervene in any of these personal decisions between a husband and his wife.
But do you see it creating a problem for women, for a woman, if she is essentially required to notify her, to let her husband know that she intends to have an abortion?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, if a wife and a husband have a good relationship, she's already communicated with him. It's only if there's a problem in their relationship that a woman would choose not to. That's a problem only she and he know about. The government doesn't know. They don't know what else is going on. It's like an abused wife who lives with a husband for a long time before anyone finds out about it. She's making a decision, a calculated decision every day about her survival, about her family. In this case, if a woman and a husband have a good relationship, she's already talked to him and he's involved in the decision.
Justices O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter, in their opinion, said essentially what you're saying. In a well-functioning marriage, they wrote, spouses discuss important intimate decisions such as whether to bear a child, but there are millions of women in this country who are the victims of regular physical and psychological abuse at the hands of their husbands. And they cited that as a very key reason for not asking the woman to notify her husband. Does that seem to occur often enough to you, Susan Hill, to override the husband's interest in the life of this fetus?
It occurs daily in clinics, for reasons that the woman sometimes explains to us and sometimes doesn't. I think Roe v. Wade protected her right to make that decision herself, as it did the right to have an abortion. At some point, you've got the government that wants to vote on every decision made in a personal decision or a marriage decision. You know, I think legislatures that believe in family rights and family values might want to think about should a man communicate to his wife that he's having an affair. that would be helpful to the wife. But I doubt the legislature is going to put that into law.
Susan Hill, we've just got you for another minute. Do you see abortion rights, despite Roe v. Wade's standing, as under attack in this country? And do you see Sam Alito, if he's confirmed to the Supreme Court, as furthering that?
Absolutely. I think it's I've been providing abortion services since 73. We've never been at a more dangerous point for women's rights and for abortion rights than we are today. And I believe that another vote on the Supreme Court against Roe is probably going to happen with the Alito nomination.
But what about the dad? Susan Hill, president of National Women's Health Organization, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to turn to our callers. Lee is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Lee?
I'm inclined to agree with the Alito point of view for one simple reason, which I believe is common sense. Fathers, whether they are a spouse or whether they are a father out of wedlock, are obligated by law to financially support the child that they father, and thereby they should have the right to at least make their case, state their case against an abortion if that's what they choose.
But if it's only about money, Lee, if there's an abortion, there won't be a child to support.
No,
so what's the relevance?
My point is that they should have a right in at least a say-so, that's not giving them decision-making power in the end. But if the state obligates a father, whether he's married or not, to support the child once it's born, he should at least have some say to try to influence the mother, if he is the father.
So you don't agree that it's the woman's issue. The fetus is in her body. This is an issue of one, a question of one.
I do, yes. It's her decision, finally. But he should at least be able to influence her to some degree. He should know about it.
And if he's told, I mean, the justice has cited millions of women in abusive relationships, you're not convinced by the threat to women who would tell a husband who would then somehow be physically or psychologically abusive in his response. That's not a big enough problem to vote the other way?
Yes, it is. If there is an abusive situation, then she does need to report that, but that should be on her as well. I mean, if she's in an abusive situation and she's about to have an abortion because of it or not, then she could get help from someone in that case.
But stand up within a conversation with the husband, not without that conversation. Lee, thank you very much for your call from Nashville. Let's turn to a call from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Daniel's calling. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Two or three little comments.
Mm-hmm.
One is, of all the possible medical issues, I happen to personally have great difficulty with abortion.
Mm-hmm.
I oppose it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, of all the possible medical decisions that a woman may have to make in a relationship with a male, why this important decision above all others requires spousal information? How about, for instance, a vasectomy? What if the male, the husband,
mm-hmm.
In a relationship decides that he wants a vasectomy, which is the same broad issue of procreation and conception, should he be required to first inform his spouse or his wife or his partner that he intends to do this?
But doesn't, when there's a fetus, when there's a pregnancy, the husband's clearly already involved at some level. I mean, isn't that a little more involvement than the sort of before the fact of a vasectomy?
Well, let's talk about a long process of family relationships. This is the same general issue of what this partnership, this relationship, this marriage may or may not produce in terms of children. Could I mention one other point?
Please,
on this discussion? As someone who once testified in opposition for an aging organization to Judge Thomas, the Anita Hill thing came in, and it blew out of the sky any other question of Judge Thomas's competence and experience
to
be a Supreme Court judge.
Yeah, so?
This is the same issue again. We're blowing, you know, it came up with Roberts. When we talk over and over and over about this, we don't talk about labor relations acts, state-federal relationships.
Yeah, we hear it. There's more, and we will get to more, but I guess it's first things first, Daniel. We appreciate your call. Cynthia Gorney, do you see women's rights as fundamentally on the line here or not?
I must say that I don't see them as fundamentally on a line with this particular subset of the abortion question.
But it does go to the whether she's empowered herself or only with her husband. Isn't that a fairly fundamental definition or defining line?
Yeah, there's a larger issue here, which is, of course, the central question of whether states are going to be permitted in the future to come up with their own abortion laws or not,
mm-hmm.
which is, of course, really the question in Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
that needs to be borne in mind. And the other thing that needs to be borne in mind also that people are, I think, losing track of a little bit in the Alito debate, although, of course, his position is very important, is that most people think right now that we still have a 6-3 court, not a 5-4 court.
Mm-hmm.
So even if he were to prove to be anti-Roe, we'd still have probably one more change that would need to be made before the big thing could possibly happen.
So this might still not be where the rubber quite meets the road. Cynthia Gorney, Richard Garnett, please stand by. We're talking about abortion, women's rights, men's rights, and Supreme Court nominee Sam Alito. What do you think? How should Alito's opinion here weigh in Senate confirmation hearings? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the case where Sam Alito and Sandra Day O'Connor parted ways, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. You can join the conversation. You've heard the story, the issue. What about the rights of would-be fathers? Could the court assert them here without retreat on women's rights? Will the high frontier of women's rights hold post-O'Connor? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I've been joined by Cynthia Gorney from Berkeley, California, author of Articles of Faith, A Frontline History of the Abortion Wars, by Richard Garnett, a professor of law at University of Notre Dame, and right now from Chicago by Jeffrey Leving. He's a family law attorney and father's rights advocate, author of Father's Rights, Hard-Hitting and Fair Advice for Every Father Involved in a Custody Dispute. Jeffrey Leving, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
So how do you see this? Sandra Day O'Connor and her colleagues Kennedy and Souter said, no, this is an imposition on the liberty of women. What about the fathers say, the husbands say here, Jeffrey?
Well, the real problem here is that the deterioration of fatherhood and family values led up to Roe versus Wade, but now societal values are changing and our society is shifting back to our traditional family values and marital dignity. Right now, we're discussing about a dissent from Samuel Alito as if he's a pro-father advocate. I don't see him as a pro-father advocate. I see him as a fair-minded judge putting the focus on the child and the family.
So you support spousal notification. Would you support a father's veto of an abortion decision?
Yes, I would. And I know a lot of people find that to be problematic, but to not support a father's right to veto an abortion, obviously, if the mother's life is in danger, I would not support a father's ability to veto abortion. But absent the mother's life or health being at risk, I would support it, because if you don't, you're denying that father equal protection and due process under the United States Constitution. And why would if we just look at a quick hypothetical to get a clear perspective on this. Why don't we just switch the gender roles in terms of the denial of legal rights in abortion? And let's assume that mom...
How do you switch the roles? That the father's going to carry the child?
No, let's assume that the mother has absolutely no legal right to determine whether or not her child will be born or aborted, and the sole decision rested with dad, and he would determine whether the child would be aborted. Yep. That would be offensive.
But that means that implicit in what you're saying is you think the definition of women's rights as voiced here by the Supreme Court has gone too far, that you don't see the woman as having that much control over her body.
I believe that we need to focus on the rights of women, men, and children, and the family. Here, the total focus is on the rights of the mother, and we're losing sight of the unborn child and of the father, and this is because of the deterioration of family values, and it's affected our society. I mean, right now, 33% of all children in America are born out of wedlock. Almost 50% of first marriages dissolve within 15 years. This is all related to the disintegration of family values, and we need to get the American family back to where it was before divorce and unwed pregnancies and father absence started causing terrible harm in our society.
And women's rights, as you define them here. Cynthia Gorney, I hear you there.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether I could respond to one point that
yes,
Mr.
Please.
Leving
mm-hmm.
made. Mm-hmm. One of the difficulties in trying to apply abortion to broad concepts like equal protection is that, unfortunately, abortion isn't like anything else. There is no other situation in which a developing life is happening inside another person's
mm-hmm.
body.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot think of another application of equal protection anywhere in American law or history that would require the use of someone else's body for 9 months in order to assert a single person's equal protection rights. It just isn't there.
Cynthia, let me
and
ask
And that's
you,
the real problem.
Can we go back to the traditional family that Jeffrey Leving is describing here without going back to a kind of patriarchal presumptions that the Supreme Court was rather explicitly rejecting in this decision, Cynthia? Can you have it both ways?
I think it's very difficult to have it both ways, and the other difficulty with applying notions of traditional family to legal abortion is that it suggests that there was not a fairly substantial abortion rate in this country before Roe v. Wade and before the practice of abortion became medicalized and became legal in every state. This practice has been with us for an awfully long time.
Jeffrey Leving, do you want a return to patriarchy? Is that what you're asking
for here? No. I'm not looking for a return to patriarchy. I'm looking for equal rights and due process. What we need to do now is balance the rights of the father with those of the mother, putting the focus on the child, and creating the most equitable law possible.
Mm-hmm.
We can't put all the focus on mom, all the focus on dad. I wouldn't mind putting all the focus on the child in certain circumstances.
But you would give the dad a veto over the abortion decision.
I wrote legislation in the state of Illinois doing that. I wrote legislation in Illinois giving a father a right to veto. Obviously, I couldn't get a sponsor, but I did get a sponsor for legislation in Illinois giving the father spousal notice. So that I did find a legislative sponsor for that.
A sponsor, not a passage as yet, but we've got the view, Jeffrey Leving, and we thank you for being there for us in Chicago. Jeffrey Leving, author of Father's Rights. So many callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. Oh, Richard, yes, please.
One very quick point. We've heard some very interesting policy arguments back and forth on
mm-hmm.
both sides, and I guess mm-hmm. I would just want to underscore that in Judge Alito's view, and he said this explicitly in his opinion, it's not the business of the judge to decide whether these laws are a good idea. I think reasonable people could differ on that. I think the legal question, the constitutional question, is whether judges should decide the matter or whether legislators should decide the matter.
Yes, and judges have decided the matter for some time now. And, of course, there's a big conservative school that would like to turn that back over to the states with exactly what that suggests. So, I mean, it doesn't change the question about the rights. In fact, that's the path to in no small number of states, presumably, turning back those rights. Am I not correct, Richard Garnett?
I think actually predictively I'd probably disagree. I think if Roe were overturned that we'd end up with an abortion regime in most states that looks a lot like the one we have now.
Let's turn to our callers. Louisville, Kentucky. Carrie's calling. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, when I was with a man that wasn't married to, my family disliked him because they knew he beat me up, and I wound up in the hospital a lot of times.
Okay, what happened?
And he kicked me all in my stomach. I was 22 and a half weeks pregnant.
So 5 months and some pregnant. You
right.
were kicked in the stomach by a husband or a boyfriend?
Boyfriend, living lover there.
So what does that leave you thinking about whether or not a husband, which is what this case required, should be notified of an abortion, Carrie?
I think he should be notified because when a man and woman join together in holy matrimony, and I believe the Holy Bible to be the law of God, the Word of God, and the Constitution is based on a lot of the laws in Deuteronomy and the Old Testament.
And you're saying even after having been kicked in the stomach at 5 and a half months pregnant by your boyfriend, you still support notification. You're just the kind of case that Justice
yes.
Sandra Day O'Connor was concerned about. Do you think that a boyfriend or a husband should have a veto over the abortion decision, Carrie?
No, I do not. I believe that, you know, the with God and And we can't serve two masters. We serve God. This is a God-fearing country, United States of America. On the back of a dollar bill is a pyramid with an all-seeing, all-knowing, all-being eye. And it says, in God we trust.
Do you trust that women's rights would be fully respected if abusive husbands had to be notified?
Yes.
You'd notify them anyway.
They need to be notified.
Yeah, we got it right out of Deuteronomy. Carrie, thank you very much for calling from Louisville. Let me get a call from Newton, Massachusetts. Barbara's on the line. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I think it's basically a matter of privacy, and if we consider this a matter of privacy, that means it's private with one person, not a group, and it becomes a matter of control, who's controlling his body. The issue of having the husband control or decide is akin to having the father control or decide. And in the perfect world, the father decides what's best for his child. In the perfect world, a couple discusses an abortion and makes a decision. But as we just heard from the previous caller, the world isn't always perfect. And sometimes the fathers rape the daughter. And then, you know, people like you have on your show will say, well, you know, she has recourse. She can go to the courts, to the police. But it's her father. And that recourse isn't always possible because it's not a perfect world.
Barbara, you're essentially saying what Sandra Day O'Connor said in her opinion. Let me ask you, if this is, as Richard Garnett says, if in an Alito era this is turned back to state legislatures, do you think women's rights will be fully protected?
No. No, because it's a matter of privacy. I mean, in your gut, in all of our guts, we have to know that this woman, a woman becomes pregnant, she has to make this decision. And of course, in a decent marriage, she discusses it. And of course, in a decent world, it's a joint decision. But you have to make laws for the exceptions. You have to protect. Those are the people you want to protect. You're not protecting someone from Lily White Newton or upper-class Boston. Those aren't the people you need to protect.
Well, you may be protecting women there, too. I think that this kind of thing can happen anywhere, but we've got it loud and clear, Barbara. Thanks for your call. Let me get one more call here from Washington, D.C. Lindsay's on the line. Hi, Lindsay. What do you think?
Hello. Good morning. I think that a lot of callers are forgetting that there is a caveat in Casey that, you know, if a woman thinks there's imminent harm to herself, she doesn't need to
she can opt out. And yet the Supreme Court said, well, in spite of that, we're concerned about her vulnerability to an abusive husband. You think you don't share that concern?
I absolutely share that concern, primarily because it's very hard to predict whether your husband will become abusive or what his reaction will be. And I just wanted to point out that pregnant women, by far, have the highest homicide rate of any demographic in America.
Is that
and
true?
Therefore, we have to be concerned about that because you may know that your husband is abusive, so you can apply this Casey caveat, but you may not know. It may come completely out of the blue, and we need to be concerned with that. And we need to be concerned with the very high rate of homicide.
So what does it say to you about Judge Alito that in trying to interpret Sandra Day O'Connor, he went the other way here, Lindsay?
It concerns me because I don't think he understands the real-world implications of this, the criminal law implications of this, and the implications for a woman who is pregnant, what actually happens on the ground.
Lindsay, we've got it. Thank you very much for your call. And maybe one more here. From Charleston, South Carolina, Rhonda is calling. Hi, Rhonda. You're on the air.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to make the point that, and I'll paraphrase, I'm not sure exactly the verbiage that Julio used the ruling, but he felt that the women who would be benefited by this was an insignificant number or not significant enough.
That was Richard Garnett's characterization, yeah.
That was his characteristic. Okay. But the problem with that thinking is that it fails to protect the very people that our laws are written for. I think that the weak and the disadvantaged who might be born into a situation like this, or certainly a woman who is in a situation like this, is the very person that this ruling was designed to try to protect.
A woman who'd be afraid to talk to her husband. Rhonda, do you see your understanding of your proper liberty as an American woman being impinged upon if this a kind of spousal notification was in effect.
Absolutely, because I agree with the previous caller from Massachusetts, I believe, who said it is a right of privacy. So I think this impacts probably several areas of our Constitution, and that is, you know, that our laws are supposed to be designed to protect the weak and the disadvantaged who can't otherwise protect itself, and also, you know, our right to privacy.
Rhonda, we've got it. Thank you very much for your call. Cynthia Gorney, we've heard about state legislatures and their authority. What about the issue of privacy, which, of course, is at the middle of Roe v. Wade? Was that central to Planned Parenthood versus Casey, too, or is that somehow peripheral in this case?
Well, the issue of privacy is central to every abortion case that comes before the court. It is fundamentally, it is, of course, at the heart of the original Roe v. Wade ruling, and it is at the heart of the public conversation, I believe, about this issue and why this particular corner of it is kind of emotional for people. I mean, what we're really talking about is, as I suggested earlier, this unique situation in which the father certainly has an interest in this thing that's growing, but unfortunately the thing that's growing is inside somebody else's body. There is no other circumstance like that in child custody law or any other way that we think about the father's rights and interest in the child.
And what about then where the country stands as a whole? We see, again, polls say Americans think the father ought to be informed. The Supreme Court said otherwise. Richard Garnett says, let's all just calm down. It's fine. Let's let the states decide. But, of course, that might well mean a reversal of this. Is the Supreme Court's role to stand up, define a woman's rights and freedom and liberty and defend it against all comers, including legislatures, or should it stand aside?
Well, the other thing I would suggest is that the problem with abortion polling, which is, of course, true for all polling, but I maintain it's truer for abortion polling, is that it depends just entirely on how the question is phrased. And I don't know how the questions about fathers' interests in the pregnancy are phrased, but I would just guess that the numbers change rather dramatically if the question is rephrased as, do you believe that regardless of the situation of the marriage, regardless of whether the woman fears that there may be some harm to her that comes from it, laws should require notification of the father? I don't think that's how the original questions were phrased, and I think that when people answer these questions quickly in the context of a telephone poll or whatever, they tend to answer them in the context of what we think of as a reasonably healthy marriage.
And
most people would say, of course the father has a right to know. Mm-hmm. They're not thinking about the kinds of circumstances that Susan Hill, the clinic director, was alluding to earlier in your program. Mm.
Richard Garnett, we've just got a minute left here. I guess at the end of the day, we come down to this split in the decisions of O'Connor and Alito. Does that say to you that if Judge Alito is confirmed, we will have a different Supreme Court? We will no longer have an O'Connor-style swing here. It'll be something new and maybe headed in a different direction.
I think it definitely will. I think the court will decide differently and function differently, not just with the replacement of Justice O'Connor, but with the addition of Chief Justice Roberts as well. And, of course, those differences will be seen in a number of areas and not just abortion. On the question of abortion, of course, I suspect that Judge Alito will not be looking for ways to expand the right to abortion, but I also don't see anything that suggests that he's going to be itching to overturn Roe versus Wade.
Of course, expansion, restriction. We look at Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and there's a story to be told in itself there. We've heard it this hour with your help. Richard Garnett at Notre Dame, thank you so much for being with us in this conversation.
It's my pleasure.
And Cynthia Gorney at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Articles of Faith, A Frontline History of the Abortion Wars. Cynthia, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.